As we know, there are all sorts of changes in the provision of women's healthcare, some of it good and some of it not so good, in our maternity hospitals, and they've changed significantly in this country in the last couple of years. Well, my next guest is a woman who has written very openly about her own fertility issues. Emily Pine is now taking up a new role as a writer in residence at the National Maternity Hospital in Holles Street in Dublin. And you're very, very welcome. Before I go to your new role, let's talk a little bit about where you have come from in all of this area of fertility, because when you came in, I said to you, you're a very brave woman, because this is something that was quite traumatic for you. You've written about it. And
I have. Yeah, I have. I wrote in Notes to Self, which is a collection of essays about my life. And the kind of central one for me is an essay called From the Baby Years, which is about the years that my partner and I spent trying to have children. And I, you know, the word that I kept coming up against was and failing, you know. And one of the most lonely and difficult things about infertility is that feeling that you are failing. And every month, you know, not reaching your goal, and you set everything about it. And those 3 or 4 years, my whole life became about that quest and also that failure. And so part of writing about it was to try and open it up, because I had felt so lonely. And I think that was, it's such an enclosed thing. I was thinking, if, you know, if you broke your leg and you went to work, it would be visible.
Yeah.
And people would talk about it, and it's not personal and it's not emotional, so you can be open about it. But when it's something that emotional and that close to you, and after we'd had a miscarriage, and I just couldn't talk about it. So years after that, I thought, right, let's start opening this
looking
up.
Looking at this. And the miscarriage was at 10 weeks.
That's right.
And people, generally speaking, don't talk about being pregnant until 12 weeks.
I know.
For the obvious reasons,
yeah.
I suppose.
Yeah.
So tell me about that.
Well, it was a really hard, I mean, we were delighted to be pregnant and really excited and kind of saw our whole lives opening up. But then I was bleeding. And I just had this really strong sense. I mean, like you do, and in lots of cases it works out, but I had this really strong sense that something wasn't right. And went to the went for a scan in Holles Street, and it was, you know, the scanner wasn't good enough or whatever. I would have to come back a few days later, and then a few days later came back, and you know, there's all this stress and all this waiting, and it's really hard. And we were told, there was a midwife came in, and then a second midwife came in, and they wouldn't talk to us. And it was really strange. And they were just looking at the floor, and they said that they couldn't say anything. And we'd never been through any of this before, you know, and didn't understand what was going on. And they said that there was no heartbeat, but there had been fetal growth. And this, again, we kind of had to work to translate it, and then they just left the room, and we were just there by ourselves looking at each other, not sure exactly what had happened. And we left, and we were told to come back again in 2 weeks for another scan. And I just thought, I don't understand. And so we had another scan, and again it was ambiguous, and eventually we ended up paying to go to a private clinic. And I remember thinking, when the midwife came into the waiting room, that she had an English accent. And I thought, oh, maybe someone not Irish will tell us the truth. And she was risking her job, and also, you know, it was against the law. She told us that she didn't think that the pregnancy was viable. And was that
against the law?
Well, what we think, and again, it's all kind of ambiguous, but what we think it fell under was this idea that, you know, because of the Eighth Amendment, nobody could be told that a pregnancy was over if there was some kind of fetal growth. It was ambiguous. And so we were stuck in this really odd, and it's strange because, and a lot of this came out around the referendum, you know, we were stuck in this situation where we really, really wanted to have children. And so we never thought that legislation would apply to us. But actually it caught us, so that for 3 weeks I was walking around still pregnant, but with a non-viable pregnancy. And so it was only then after the final 3 weeks later, after the final scan, that the language and the attitude changed completely, and people were consoling us, and we were brought into the grief room, and then a surgeon came in and said that I would have a surgical procedure to end the pregnancy. Yeah. And it was this complete shift where suddenly we were being talked to, and suddenly I was back to being the main patient and I was being communicated with. And it was this really strange experience where, you know, you're lying on a couch and there's a scan going on, everybody's looking at the screen, and you realise that you have no control or knowledge about your own body in this context.
Right. But you were heartbroken that you'd lost a baby.
Heartbroken.
Yeah.
Yeah. Still, I still am. And, you know, and then afterwards, you know, we thought, okay, well, we'll go back to trying, and went on for several years, but it
Does
didn't
that
happen
ruin
again.
Your love life or your sex life?
I'm saying it's not good. It's not healthy, because everything becomes about it. And like I said, that word failure, I think as well, failure is really hard to deal with when it's happening inside your own body. And I blamed myself a lot and found it really hard even to talk to my partner about it, who's, you know, my best friend. But, you know, we were lonely in different ways, and it took over. It does. And, you know, I think that was, we eventually decided we were on the cusp of doing IVF, and we eventually decided not to do it.
And talk me through that, because a lot of people are doing IVF now.
And I wish them the best of luck.
Of course, I really
do.
But it seems to be associated with people trying to have children older. I don't know if that's scientific, but it's certainly anecdotally so. And why did you decide against?
I was older. Your class, if you're over 35, your class is geriatric,
know,
right?
Yeah.
I was 38 and or maybe 39, and the odds we were being given were really low, and nobody was able to tell us why we hadn't become pregnant. And all of the tests came back completely normal. And all of the conversations that I was having with midwives and nurses and fertility specialists, where I was saying, you know, my body is behaving in this way, and they didn't seem that interested. And I actually, my reaction was that if you're not interested in what my body and how in what's actually happening, I don't see how IVF is going to fix all of that. And there was this phrase where the specialist said that they would, you know, implant, they would, she didn't say they would implant the embryos. She said, we throw them in and hope something sticks. I mean, this is my life. And we had this conversation, and we had lots of conversations, but we had this one conversation where my partner said, let's start talking about the kind of life we want to have. And for a long time, that had been a life filled with children. That had been our shared dream.
Yeah.
And that wasn't happening. And they were giving us, you know, a 20% chance that the IVF would be successful. And so I was thinking, I was dead set to do it, you know, because at that point I was just completely in
focused.
The mind, focused on
yeah.
it. And he said, let's maybe pause for a while. And that was all we decided to do. We decided to pause for a few months to just see, well, what if we step back from it? Can we think about this differently? Because the emotions were so high. And weirdly, it sounds so strange, even to me now, we became happier almost overnight. I stopped feeling like I was drowning. We started talking to each other. We started going out with friends again, like just enjoying daily life. So rather than feeling like we were failing on this long-term quest that we had, instead, we felt like we were back noticing our real lives. And that's where we are today. You know, we kept revisiting the conversation and saying, are you still happy to be paused? Are you still happy?
Yeah.
And talking about it between ourselves is the best thing that we did.
What about language? You know, you said that you use the word failure.
Oh, well, I don't anymore. And I say this in Notes to Self. I say it right at the end. I say, I'm done using the word failure about my body. And I'm done living it. I'm done talking it. I'm done writing it. Really. I feel like Notes to Self was my opportunity to write myself a happy ending.
Yeah.
And at the point at which I was writing it, it was a little bit of like wish fulfillment. But actually, it has come to pass. I feel very happy. And And that is part of the story, because it's not that I've just, you know, I've got some kind of consolation prize and, you know, I've accepted it or resigned myself to it. No, there are lots of alternate child-free versions of life that can be really happy. Right. And I'm really lucky, as Rona kept saying, as my partner kept saying, you know, you're not sick. And there's something about the fertility journey that makes you feel like you're broken and that you are sick, that there's something wrong with you because you can't conceive. So that part of my anatomy, whatever, didn't, my biology didn't come together. But I'm not actually, I have my health, and that's really precious.
Yeah. And you talk about language like childlessness.
I know. Well, I mean, it's really hard. I mean, I'm a lecturer in an English department, right, in UCD. So language, words are really important. And I remember thinking, am I childless? Or this lovely phrase, involuntarily childless, which technically is what I
accurate,
am.
Yeah.
But then, you know, that's not a very inspiring way to live your life. So child-free was a kind of term that came up, and I thought, well, it's not that I've... Child-free can be used in multiple ways, but I do actually think, well, we can have this life that doesn't have... I mean, you know, we get a lot more sleep and, you know, don't need a babysitter. And it was one of the conversations that we had where we said, okay, if we're going to have a life without children, let's have the life that you can have without kids, you know, where you do the things that are more difficult if you have kids.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. And you say your sister, who also went through... a miscarriage?
No. My sister's daughter was stillborn at 37 weeks, Elena Jane. And that puts everything into perspective. And Elena was perfect, and we were there when she was born. And Hollister were extraordinarily good. The midwives just got us through it. And it was, I mean, to hold a little baby girl. And that was the hardest thing that ever happened to our family. And my sister was heroic, and she has a gorgeous little boy now who's perfect and healthy, and we are so thankful. But you never get over the loss. We'll never get over the loss of Elena.
Right. And what did that... Was that when you were in the middle of...
Yeah, they overlapped. And it was strange, actually, because when she was pregnant, and I write about this in Notes to Self, when she was pregnant, I had just had a miscarriage, and it was really hard for me. It was really hard for me to be fully happy for her. And then I thought, that's such a terrible thing, Emily. Come on, put it to one side and be. And she included me in her pregnancy. We were all so excited and thrilled. And then for Elena to be stillborn was just everything. You look at everything differently. I mean, to lose a child.
Yeah, without a doubt. Now, you say that she's a single mum.
She is.
Yeah. And she has this little boy.
He's fantastic, yeah.
And you say she's wrecked a lot of the time.
She's exhausted, yeah, she is. You know, because single mums are. And, you know, we grew up with a single mum who did an amazing job, but must have been knackered a lot of the time. Of course, when you're small, you ignore that, you know.
Yeah.
But, her life... Her child is at the centre of her life, and that is how it should be. And that would have been the kind of parent I would have wanted to be as well.
Right.
And, you know, all of her creativity goes into looking after him, and that's fantastic. And I look at that, and I'm really lucky to be an aunt and to be a part of his life.
Yeah.
And that's a really, you know, there's a lot of ways of having a child full life without having your own biological children. But I also recognise that I get to go home and read and write. You know, I wouldn't have written Notes to Self if I had been a parent. So there are other paths that you can take, you know.
Right. Well, I suppose it's the sensible thing. There was a very nice quotation that a woman said, you can close the book, but you'll always carry the book.
Yeah, I really believe that. People say, oh, you know, have you moved on? And I think you just learn to carry it. And again, something about working in UCD, it's a big institution. I must walk past hundreds of people a day. And when something terrible, like after Elena died, I remember thinking, walking into work and somebody held the door open for me. And I thought, oh, I probably look sad. And this person is doing a nice thing. And you realise kind of the humanity of that.
Yeah.
And also that every single person you walk past has a story. every single person is probably carrying grief. And, you know, you ask them how they are and they say, fine, but there is always something underneath that someone is carrying.
Okay. Listen, I'm going to have to pause for the 12 o'clock break. I hope you will stay with
Love
us
to.
Over the break, please. And we will talk about your plans for the future. So we'll be talking to Emily Pine again after the news. But now, at 12 noon, we pause for the Angelus. Now, a caller was on to say, I come because I'm still in studio with Emily Pine talking about her experiences. I completely understand what Emily means about language. The inadequacy of verbal expression against the complexity of human experience. I'm 31. My partner died just before Christmas last year. I don't have a word or a way to say that I'm grieving now for the children we would have had together, for the life that we'll never have now, because he is forever for me. She's so right. You don't move on, you live.
Yeah. Oh, that's so sad. I'm so sorry.
Isn't it?
My heart goes out to you. And I think that exactly. I think sometimes I miss my life as a mother. This sounds strange because I never had a life as a mother, but I feel like I am missing it and I am grieving it. And I actually just can't let myself go there because I think about, you know, turning up to the school gates and somebody running over and saying, "Mummy," to me. I can't do it. Instead, I got to think about what I do have, but that's really, really hard.
Right. Well, you're taking a year off.
This is your
maternity leave.
My non-maternity leave.
Sorry,
yeah, my non-maternity leave. Yeah. Yeah, I've been lucky to work at UCD as a lecturer in drama for 10 years now, and UCD are incredibly supportive of anybody doing kind of creative projects, which is great. And so I've been able to take a 12-month sabbatical.
Now, people would say about people who couldn't have children that their heart breaks every time they see little newborn babies all looking lovely in their baby grows and in their prams and in their... And you're going to go in to work in...
The National Maternity Hospital. It's crazy.
Tell me how that came about.
It's a year now that Notes to Self is out, and I thought that I had kind of done, I had written my story and I was done with it. And after it came out and people started reading it, I started getting letters and emails and cards and just having conversations with people I met, people I didn't know, saying that their experience had been the same. And maybe some of them had done IVF, maybe some of them had gone on to have healthy children, maybe some of them had had decided to walk away as we had done.
Did adoption cross your mind?
It did, but again, adoption is not an easy process. And so I think that we had already given years of our life
right.
at that point.
Yeah.
And a couple of people suggested it, and I thought it was maybe slightly missing the point, that we had to change the terms, as it were, and create a different... I like that idea that you make your life, and this is the life that we are making.
Right. So tell me...
So now this is the life I'm making, which is walking into a maternity hospital, yeah.
Which...
I mean, I thought I was done writing that story, and here I am still talking about it, and that is because of the responses of other people.
Right.
And what I realised very, very quickly, after the kind of slight shock of I didn't anticipate people telling me their stories, and they are very moving, incredibly so, as that person who texted into the show was, there are so many stories out there. And we saw this with the referendum campaign last year. So many people telling their stories and how powerful that kind of storytelling can be. I mean, obviously to change legislation, but also to change people's minds. And like your caller said, the complexity of people's experience can't be captured. And it's, you know, it isn't captured in newspapers or in a radio interview. It actually takes kind of longevity and time. And really luckily, the master of Hollis Street...
You wrote to him.
I did, Shane Higgins, but he'd actually already read Notes to Self.
Okay.
And as a result, he knew who I was and knew the kind of stories I had told. He knew that I had very sad stories, but also that I had very happy stories to tell about Holles Street, because it isn't one side or the other. And he said, you know, what do you want from me? And I said, well, maybe I could come and spend some time here. And I think there are more stories to tell about, largely about women's health, less about babies, which is maybe a slightly self-protective thing.
Yeah.
But more thinking about the kind of conversations that we've started to have about women's health and how women are so often not listened to doctors. But then the other side of it, which is, and he would say the same, how heroic midwives are in being there for you at the most vulnerable time of your life. And one of my strongest memories, oddly, of both times that I was in Holles Street as a patient was going to the loo, and on the back of all the cubicle doors are signs about domestic violence. And how you can safely tell a member, your midwife, that you don't want your partner in the birthing room with you, and that there are female-only birthing rooms. And that is chilling. Actually, the women and children, the most vulnerable points in their life, are actually vulnerable because of lots of other things as well. And I think that kind of, that complexity and that depth of story is one that should be actually talked about more openly. Mm. Because as I have found through publishing my own story, it connects with so many others. And you think you're writing about your life, but actually you're writing about something that is so widespread. I mean, everyone has a birth story because everyone was born, right? And also, strange things came out even closer to home. I've ended up having conversations with my mum that I never would have had. And you realise, you know, she was saying, oh, well, they didn't have scans in my day. And then you start thinking about, you know, medical developments, yeah, and how that affects women's lives, and how this is a much bigger conversation about women's,
right,
health.
And I'm just trying to imagine somebody in the hospital, say a patient, will you approach them?
Absolutely not. No, I mean, I don't see myself as, I don't have an agenda to go, you know, or a clipboard. I see myself as being present and being around. And what I have found is that lots of people want to tell their stories and want to come up to you.
Right.
And there are lots of people who don't. And I, you know, we talk about silence and how there's a kind of a silence around women's bodies, and that's often taken to be a bad thing. But again, what I've discovered is that there are some people who, oddly, like me, want to break the silence, and that was right for me. But silence is a very protective thing as well. Often it's just, I mean, I couldn't have talked about it after I'd had a miscarriage. It's just too emotionally difficult. And so you can be, you, everybody should be entitled to their, right, own quiet.
There were stories told on Liveline of people from all over the country, women, who had very bad experiences. Would you feel inhibited about writing about that?
No, again, you know, they have read Notes to Self, so they do know that I have seen both sides of the spectrum.
Right.
And I also think, and this is one of the things that I said when I was talking to the board, was that patients are not the only vulnerable people in the hospital. The staff are also vulnerable, yeah, and are also going through it. I don't know. I mean, like I said, when Elena was born, the we were there for, you know, a long time. And so we went through several shifts of midwives, and they were all extraordinary in different ways. And the emotional toll it must take on them,
right,
to have to deliver bad news is, again, you know, part of it and something we're not talking about. And so, yes, and bad stories will always get headlines.
Right.
And are always going to be emotive and catch people's attention. But actually, there's usually something more complicated going
on
behind it.
What about and we leave it there then. What about the protests outside?
Well, you know, that's, as a writer, I'm going to say that's interesting. That's part of the complicatedness of it. And everybody is entitled to an opinion.
Right.
I think it's enormously insensitive to have the protests outside the hospital.
Well, I think people found perhaps the coffins were...
Well, I think it's just not fair. I mean, I think about my sister, I think about myself, I think about somebody who has just lost a child, walking out of that hospital and seeing that. The emotional impact of that is unfair. And so I think compassion needs to be at the heart of everything that we do. And some people are perhaps protesting are motivated by compassion, but some people are just angry. And we need a more, and I think we are getting to it, a more nuanced debate, a more nuanced conversation. And that's, as a writer, that's right. What I'm interested in.
Okay, and clearly what they would say is that they have their grief for the babies that were aborted, and they would say that very firmly. Anyway, we'll leave it there for the moment. Hey, when will we feel your presence, so to speak?
I'm starting in September.
Okay. Listen, very nice to talk to you, Emily Pine, and thank you very, very much indeed.
Podcast The Marion Finucane Show at rte.ie/radio.